Welcome to our third session on Hebrews with Professor Jennifer Kalin from Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Today's topic is a portrait of Jesus. And now Jennifer will open us in prayer.
Will you pray with me? Our Lord and our God, we thank you for yet another opportunity to come together to study your word. We thank you that even as we witness this change in seasons, that we may also witness a change in ourselves and each other as we grow closer to you. Bless our time together. Direct us to fulfill your purpose in all that we do. We ask these and all things in the precious name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. So good morning. I actually want to begin in some ways kind of where we left off last week. And unfortunately, I'm not in the space with you all because where we left off was with a question adjacent to maybe, adjacent to, but I also think in some ways connected to this conversation that we are having about Hebrews, to a larger conversation we will have, continue to have about Hebrews. And I certainly hope the person who asked the question is in the room. But the question that was posed kind of right at the end of the session, and I didn't want to kind of begin to answer it because I didn't feel that I would be able to fully answer it, was about something to the extent of woke culture and perhaps what woke culture or wokeness, if you will, is doing to our culture. And I'm grateful for the question because I feel that means that we created a space, at least last week, we created a space where we feel comfortable having these kinds of conversations together. And so I want to start by just saying, and these are my musings, please, just these are my thoughts. So I also welcome and invite other thoughts on this as well. But woke is a term that we are using right now. And I want to emphasize that we are using right now, specifically in this American context, North American context, to describe being socially and politically aware of issues in our society. And the reason I'm offering that very simple definition is to uncharge, if you will, to uncharge the world, the word itself. So that we know in and of itself, the term, right? The term it has no meaning except for what we give to it. And we see this happen a great deal. But this term is a charged term in our society right now, for good or for bad. And that is something that I think is important for us to discuss, is how words trigger potential meanings. We'll see this, I think, in the text of Hebrews, right? So the word itself triggers certain political ideologies or positionings in ways that I think really mirror the debates of more recently, like the 1980s, right? We remember hearing the word politically correct, right? And thinking initially, I was a little younger then, thinking, well, that's the thing you want to do, right? You want to be correct. But the term was very much used in the same way, I think, that this term woke is being used today. And you say these words in the 80s or in today, and literally the temperature in the room changes, right? It either increases or decreases. And my thoughts around that word in our culture, in the way it's functioning today, is something that I try to instill in my own children, which is that words have the potential to inflict harm, right? So unlike that nursery rhyme that words will never hurt us, that's not true. That is what I've come to teach them, is that it's not true. And this particular word serves as lightning, right? Because of the charge that I mentioned before. So it's a lightning. And there are other words that there's probably a constellation of words that we could add to that. And lightning in and of itself can be dangerous, right? Lightning serves a function, has an important function for climate, but in and of itself, it can be dangerous. And so I just think that it's important, right? it is important that we identify issues that we need to address in society. Even if we can't agree on what these issues are, and more importantly, if we can't agree on how to solve them, right? And so as Christians in particular, I think it's our duty to be able to have civil conversations, productive conversations, to better understand each other around these issues. And so the Bible for me serves as a lightning rod, if you will, right? Protecting us from some of the danger, right, that can come from these terms that I think politically seek to separate us, right? So if we have the lightning rod, in this case, the Bible, if you work with my imagery here, then I think the Bible helps us to rightly understand each other on terms that are different, right? On terms that are different, are neutral, if you will, or should be neutral. And so that's how I feel about it, right? I think there will be other terms. There have been terms like this in the past. There will be others to come. And I just think we as Christians, should not fall prey to kind of the divisiveness that comes with those things, right? But as the Bible instructs us to be alert, to be aware, and to work, kind of as I prayed, to fulfill God's purpose on the earth, which hopefully we'll see more of in Hebrews. And hopefully that was a full enough answer to how I feel about kind of language, divisive language, hurtful language, and helpful language. It can all be found in one word, I think. I will, hearing no response, I will kind of jump right in to my objectives for today. So today, we are going to be looking at a portrait of Jesus, or maybe really different portraits of Jesus, as we look at four different ways that Jesus is described in the book of Hebrews. So next slide, if you will. I want to shift our attention. Last week, we kind of talked about ourselves and thinking about genealogies. And in doing so, my hope was to connect us to the text, right? And so now, today, what I'm hoping we can do is actually kind of shift our focus to Jesus, who we find in the text. And then we'll kind of combine those things next week as we're looking at themes, various themes across the text. But today, what I want us to consider is how Hebrews contributes to what we know about Jesus, because I think it does so in a very unique way. And then once we have this knowledge of what Hebrews is attempting to teach us about Jesus, how we can better relate to Jesus, perhaps, because of these kind of new understandings. Next slide, please. So in the Gospels, Jesus poses this question, that I'm kind of starting with, and I'm actually going to end with this question as well. So you'll have time to respond now, but you'll also have an opportunity to think about it and respond later if you choose. But it is, who do you say that I am? Right? Jesus asked the question of his disciples, who do you, right? And this gives us an implication, or what the implication of the question is that there are things being said about Jesus outside of this group. And who do you individually, personally think that Jesus is? And so what are the first words? I've listed a few here, not necessarily adjectives, but nouns. What are the first kind of images of Jesus that come to mind when you hear the name? And that wasn't rhetorical. I'm wondering, outside of teacher, shepherd, savior, are there others that you would list here that you think of when you hear the name Jesus?
I'm not getting any hands here.
Did I cover it? Did I cover all the bases?
Yeah, you took all the low fruit.
Messiah, Christ. I often tell my students, Christ is not Jesus's last name, right? It means anointed one, although we see the combination of Jesus and Christ together often. So again, this list isn't exhaustive, which I'm hoping. Yes.
Okay. I know this is a word usually reserved for another member of the Trinity, but I think of Jesus as an advocate. He is an advocate for the poor and for, as he puts it, the least of these. So
yes,
I will add that.
Thank you, advocate.
Yeah, this is Doug Mitchell. He is the advocate for all of us. That's the relationship between him and the Godhead that I see.
And that is, I will be using the word mediator in just a moment, but yes, yes.
Bobby gets an A+ for that answer. That was really good.
I think of Jesus as, I think of the word brother, since we have the same father.
Yes.
He's my brother.
Yes, that sibling relationship is underscored a great deal in the text of Hebrews, right? This is what leads me to the whole genealogy conversation. We are heirs to the promises alongside Jesus. Yes, yes, brother, advocate, any others?
How about Lord?
Yes, Lord.
Very good.
Lord of the Sabbath. I'm thinking of the gospel story there. But yes.
Lord of the dance.
Indeed.
Hi. I'm wondering, along Bobby's thought of advocate, didn't Jesus ask God to send the Holy Spirit to us, a counselor for us on earth after he left the earth?
Yes.
So speaking of the Holy Trinity, you know, that's a pretty big ask of God, and we are so blessed.
Yes, a counselor, a comforter. I think in the Gospel of John, right? A comforter. Yes. So such a beautiful way of thinking of kind of the extended role of Jesus in his care, which is another one of the things that I think comes out in the way that Jesus is described in the book of Hebrews. So thank you so much. We'll add those to our working list.
One more, so, Prince of Peace.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Doug Mitchell back again. How about the Word? Let's not forget the book of John.
Yes, the Word itself, right? Prince of Peace.
And in a sense, that book really ascribes to him a pivotal role in creation, which I'm still confused and, you know, mystery befuddled.
Oh, yes.
You know, we yes. commonly say that God created the heavens and the earth, but then John basically says the Word is how this thing came into being. He spoke it into being.
Yes. And Hebrews actually affirms that, which is an excellent segue into exactly where I'm going. Thank you for that. I'm going to talk about it in four titles, four additional titles, if you will. And the next title, if you will, on the next slide is Jesus as the Exalted Son. And so what I have on the majority of these slides are just scripture. So you can kind of just pick up a Bible and follow along, or you can go back and kind of reference these. If you will, but Jesus as Exalted Son, the very first chapter of Hebrews, the entire first chapter, I think is really dedicated to, if you recall, we say Hebrews is a sermon. And if that's the case, then this introduction is dedicated to reminding its audience of who Jesus is, right? Reminding the audience of who Jesus is. And it begins by clearly designating Jesus as the Son who God has appointed heir of all things. Jesus is then described as the reflection of God's glory, the exact imprint of God's very being. And he sustains all things by his powerful word, right? By his powerful word. So alongside the Gospel of John, the book of Hebrews is one of the places where we see Jesus as co-creator, or at least as present, if you will, at creation. Also, there's a bit of a maybe an aside, but certainly a pretty long exposition here in the book of Hebrews around a hierarchy, or it's described as such, right? So we have Jesus and God who are seated on a throne in heaven, Jesus at the right hand, of course, which means the strong side, right? Or designation of strength. We see this with the naming of Benjamin. Benjamin means the son of my right hand. So Jesus is seated at the right hand of God on high, who is now superior to the angels, right? So he's, we'll see in just a moment that Jesus is made a little lower than the angels, right? So humanity, he becomes human, and then is elevated back to his kind of rightful position. This is, again, in Hebrews, one of the places where we see what we would refer to kind of as a very high Christology. Christology meaning the study of Christ, right? And we often designate a Christology as either high or low. High, meaning that Jesus is fully divine. That's the highest of Christologies, right? It's so the divine understanding of who Jesus is versus a low a Christology. And that low Christology is more concerned with the life of Jesus, or the humanity, right, if you will, of Jesus. And so the Gospel of John, which was already mentioned in the beginning, right, as in Genesis 1, in the beginning, while beginnings, God created the heavens and the earth. And you hear echoes, I think, of that here in Hebrews as well, where at creation, Jesus is present as wisdom, right? It kind of harkens the wisdom tradition, if you will, there with God at creation. Jesus becomes a little lower than the angels to suffer, right? So it's just kind of really the summary of who Jesus is and what Jesus did on behalf of this audience, right? On behalf of this early Christian group. So Jesus, who suffered death, is now crowned with glory and honor, so that he tasted death for everyone. And so this is another kind of role of Jesus, as we'll see. It's kind of difficult to parse these out because I think they all go together for the writer of Hebrews and audience of Hebrews, which is us, right? We're part of that audience as well. But Jesus becomes the first, right? So he tastes death on our behalf so that we, those who follow, do not have to taste death, right? So we are all resurrected. In other words, what else do I want to say about Jesus as the exalted son? Oh, yes. This lengthy description in Hebrews 1 also, I think, is important to point out the term son here. And often it's my son. In Hebrews 1:5, the verse that follows what's here before you, Jesus, God says, that Jesus is my son. And so there's a very personal connection to God that is being identified, while at the same time, you know, since we've been talking about the Trinity this morning, there's a distinction that is made. There is still a personal relationship that between Father and Son that is really important to emphasize for this group, but also for us, right? And I think one of the reasons this is important is because of who the audience is and what they as a group are experiencing, right? So it's important to kind of go back to week one as we were thinking about this, what we do know, what we can reconstruct of the original audience is that they are in some ways suffering. We do not know what the suffering is. The text just simply says that they have not yet suffered to the death. So they are being persecuted in some ways, but not yet being martyred, if you will. But the suffering is what seems to link this message of Jesus intimately to the audience. And so Hebrews, in some ways, is defending the deity of Christ, right? In chapter one, extensively, but really throughout the book, connecting a lot to the Psalms, as well as Genesis 1, that Jesus is anointed and chosen by God. He too receives worship, which we'll talk about in just a moment. And in every respect, as kind of indicated here, is the glory and majesty and power and very nature, if you will, of God. We find that in Jesus. And so Jesus as the exalted Son, I think, is a distinction from Jesus as the Son, which we see portrayed in other New Testament texts. So that's the distinction that I'm hoping we see here in Hebrews. The next slide, please. The next designation of Jesus in the book of Hebrews is that of the high priest. And this is an introduction of a title that we find nowhere else in the New Testament for Jesus, and that is describing Jesus as high priest. Again, in chapter two, we see that Jesus became like his brothers and sisters, right? So someone mentioned that, his brothers and sisters in every respect, so that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the service to God, of God, to make a sacrifice of atonement for the sins of the people. So Jesus is not simply a high priest. Jesus is an empathetic priest, one who continues to hear and make intercessions for his siblings, right? For his siblings. So in chapter three, at the very beginning, we see again Jesus described as an apostle, which is, I think, also very interesting, but also as the high priest of our confession, who was faithful. And this is also kind of a thematic thing that we'll pick up on again next week, but the faithfulness of Jesus becomes something that we as followers of Jesus are to imitate. And once this title of high priest is introduced, then the writer goes through a great description, spends several chapters continuing to describe what that means, right? In terms of what that means for Jesus and how Jesus is a distinctive high priest, not like the high priest that this audience might have historically heard about or be familiar with, because certainly there were priests within kind of Roman religions, but also the priesthood within Judaism as well. And so in chapter four, again, continuing to help us understand what it means to think of Jesus as a high priest is that Jesus passed through the heavens, right? And so this idea, my words really, of the demotion promotion, right? This movement of Jesus from heaven, right? So this eternal presence becomes kind of temporal in this short moment and does this ministry and then returns to heaven, right? And so Jesus is a great high priest who has passed through the heavens in both directions, has come down and returned back to the heavens. And as the Son of God, we should hold fast to the confession of our faith. Again, connecting who Jesus is to how we as Christians are supposed to be, because we are called to imitate in this book, right? We are called to imitate Christ. And part of that is Christ's faithfulness, right? Because Christ remains faithful, we too should be faithful. And specifically to this audience who is experiencing suffering, which may be causing them to waver a little bit in their faith. It is also in the following chapter in Hebrews 5, where we see that Jesus is described as a priest who lasts forever, according to the order of Melchizedek, right? So a name that we only see mentioned a couple of times here in Hebrews, once in the Psalm and once in the Torah in relationship to Abraham. So we know very little historically about this priest, Melchizedek, except that he's anointed by God and that Abraham brings an offering, right? It's the first instance of a tie, but Abraham brings an offering to Melchizedek. And the establishment of his priesthood is a lasting one. And therefore, this is the connection, if you will, to the priesthood of Jesus, is that once Jesus is designated priest, it lasts forever, right? Which is a distinction from other high priests who, upon their death, a new high priest is chosen. And this, of course, this title in many ways institutes Jesus as the mediator of a new covenant, Hebrew 12, we see that, and we'll talk about that more in the description of Jesus as kind of a pioneer in just a second. So next slide, please. What does it mean to be a high priest? I think it's important to just pause since this is kind of a newer designation in the New Testament specifically. So priesthood historically, if we're looking at traditional Judaism, was through the line of Aaron, but high priests came from the Levitical priesthood. And so the high priest, to be distinguished from kind of the rest of the priests, had special responsibilities that set them apart. One is that they were, as Leviticus outlines, they were to be physically, right, without any defect, but also spiritually, if you will, without any defect, meaning that their conduct was holy, a standard that separated them, if you will, apart from others. And so the responsibilities for the priests generally is that they were mediators, right? And we can think of that in today's terms as well, right? Priests, ministers function as mediators between the people and God, right? Bringing messages from God to the people, praying on behalf of the people to God, offering sacrifices on behalf of the people to God historically. But again, what Jesus does is implement a new way of worship, right? Because if there's no need for sacrifice, then how do we worship? Sacrifice was a form of worship. And Jesus begins this new covenant as a priest, saying that there's a new way for us to worship, that we worship God in spirit and in truth through the sacrifice of our lips, right? Through our praise, through what we say is one of the ways that we can worship God, because there's no need for sacrifice after Jesus. So this is the second title. First, exalted Son of God. Second is high priest. So just two more. So next, in the next slide, very much connected to Jesus's priesthood is Jesus as sacrifice. So Jesus, has this kind of duality of roles in many ways. So Jesus offers the sacrifice, and it is also the sacrifice itself, right? So the sacrifice that Jesus offers on behalf of humanity is himself.
We have a question in the chat.
Yes, please.
Sorry, I must not be wide enough awake here. When you were talking about high priest and high priest as mediator, maybe I'm wrong, but mediator is sort of a neutral term, not taking perhaps a strong stance like Bobby's suggestion of being an advocate. I guess I think of high priest as being more like a role model and having more of a position on standards or issues. And I was quiet, but when I think of Jesus, I think of Jesus as an example,
for
what we're supposed to be doing.
Absolutely. And thank you for that distinction. Yes. I mean, kind of emphasizing both and as opposed to either or. But yes, I think that's an important distinction to make. well, I don't necessarily see mediators as neutral, kind of in, I think, as we think of mediators of law in conflict, in our kind of, in the way we think of in our kind of modern sense, yes. But mediator as one who stands between is really, I think, how I and others use this to describe Jesus in this way, right? And other priests, really, right? The one who stands between God and humanity, which might be a better way of thinking of it than, maybe there's a better word, I should say, than mediator, given how we understand that today. But I thank you, and I do appreciate that as role model, because I think in the next kind of designation, that's what we, exactly what comes out from the writer of Hebrews. Again, connected to this role of priesthood is that Jesus did not have to offer sacrifice, right? And there's this very important distinction that the writer continues to make, right? So while Jesus is in heaven, Jesus is not an angel, right? And so he goes into this long description of how Jesus is not an angel. And then as he describes Jesus or designates Jesus as a priest, then he goes into this long description of how Jesus is not like other priests, right? So while Jesus is a priest, he's not like any other priest we have ever known, in that he does not have to make a sacrifice for his own sin because Jesus is without sin, right? And so when Jesus offers himself the perfect sacrifice, he does it once and for all. Then there's no need, right? It does away with the need for any other additional sacrifice. And as such, Jesus becomes another kind of descriptor, if you will, the guarantee, right? Or the surety, if you will, of this new covenant, or as described in the text, this better covenant. That is being implemented because of the work of Jesus, which is his death and resurrection. And so Jesus as our sacrifice, and sacrifice, I think, again, we see this in, I think, the Gospels and in the writings of Paul, certainly, the understanding of what Jesus did on the cross as atonement here, I think is making very clear that Jesus is not only a sacrifice, but the final sacrifice, right? So Jesus's sacrifice completely changes how we understand our relationship, right? That's the covenant, our relationship to God. Which brings me to our next slide. And I think kind of, again, the culmination, if you will, of all these kind of various descriptors. The fourth and final is Jesus as a pioneer. And this is a word that is found in the text itself, but Jesus as a pioneer, also as the writer, the author, and the finisher in many ways of our faith. And so this is another thread that we see throughout these 13 chapters in the book of Hebrews, beginning with in the second chapter, that it was fitting for God whom and through whom all things exist and bringing many children, right, to glory. Again, this co-inheritance, all of us together, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through suffering. So Jesus, the pioneer of our salvation, of our faith, is perfected through suffering. As again, sorry, I didn't catch the name of the last speaker, but as she was saying, right, that perfection through suffering becomes an example for this suffering audience so that their salvation is perfected as well, right? To stay faithful as Jesus was faithful. And so Jesus becomes the forerunner as he's described in the sixth chapter. As the one who goes before us, as the role model, if you will, the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. And so, again, if we think back to, you know, the very foundations, if you will, that we try to lay in the conversation around the audience and the writer. Who that might have been, right? The unknown audience, the unknown writer. and what we can piece together historically of this first century audience, it's important to think of what we do know, which is that this audience would have, or they are getting a message from the writer to hold fast to their faith, to kind of hang in there, because as they're telling this story, again, thinking of it as a sermon, as they're telling this story, it's a reminder, a constant reminder of who Jesus is, right? Jesus is the exalted Son. So we're not going to be defeated forever, right? We as a people will be like Jesus, one day exalted. Jesus is also the high priest, right? And so in your suffering, know that you have someone who you can pray to, someone who has made God available to us, right? And so as they're talking about the priesthood, there's also this description that we can come boldly to God, right? That we, there's no veil. The veil has been removed so that we can go boldly to the throne of grace and receive grace. From God. And then Jesus as our, as the sure testament, right, as the surety or as the sacrifice for us, understanding that that sacrifice was once and for all, so that we don't have to, right, suffer to the end, but knowing that our relationship to God has been shored up, the covenant is made complete or whole because of what Jesus did on the cross for us. And then finally, this understanding as Jesus, as our forerunner, if you will, as the pioneer, as the one who has gone before us, it means that the path to God has been paved, made clear, if you will, to God by Jesus. And we, as followers of Jesus, need only to follow in this path. Next slide, because I will pause at the next slide for questions and thoughts and engagement, kind of before I offer a couple of things. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of open up our discussion for a little bit to think about this question, right? This question in light of these four additional ways of thinking about Jesus. And you offered even more at the beginning in response to this question is who do we say that Jesus is? And we talked about what images come to mind for us, but which of these various images, and I think this is kind of a question of audience, right? What do we need from Jesus? And I think what we need, we find either through the Gospels or here in Hebrews that offers us some additional ways of thinking about Jesus, right? So which of the images, and you know, less so about the art, but more so about the images of God, that we, of Jesus that we find in the text, resonate with you and why? Is it Jesus as the anointed one? Is it Jesus as priest? Is it Jesus as Lord, right? As ruler, as king, or, which resonates with you perhaps? And then how might that image be helpful for us in the church today or in the world even today?
So this is Ted, and I'll, this might be a bit of a tangent, but I'll take a bit of issue with Leviticus talking about high priests being physically perfect on two counts. One, because most human specimens are not perfect. We all have our flaws. And you know, and then furthermore, it's a kind of a seed of a thought that says that if we have a physical defect or disability, that somehow we are separated from God. And I think Jesus rejected that in the parable of the blind man, who is this that sinned, this blind man or his parents, so that God punished him with his blindness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Doug. I'm just wondering, if there is a parallel between that description of the high priest, and I don't mean Jesus at this point, I mean the Levites. It seems to me that that performs the same function as saying that the Pope is infallible.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me there the positioning there is one of attempting for the people to revere these people in these positions. So I'm not sure about the text and whether or not it justifies all of that, yet perhaps it does say that Jesus is a valid, perfect high priest.
Mm-hmm. And so two things. Thank you, Ted. I certainly agree that Jesus would kind of reject this notion of perfection as we understand it, but this is a theme that we will definitely pick up and talk about, because it's one that comes throughout, you find throughout the book of Hebrews, this notion of perfection in a way that you don't find this in other texts. But perfection is two things, right? Perfection as it relates to us is not the same as being perfect as we understand it. So the Greek term for protection in for perfection in Hebrews is actually more akin to complete or wholeness, right? That you'll be made whole or that you'll be made complete. And that word is translated as that you'll be made perfect, right? Which I don't think has the same kind of connotations in our modern society. Now, the idea of the perfect sacrifice as it relates to Jesus and kind of the priesthood, I think that language, kind of that Hebrew Bible, Leviticus language, as Doug pointed out, was more so about the standard that was being set for the priesthood and also the standard that was set for sacrifices, right? Was that, again, wholeness, completeness, was not that you don't bring the worst of your flock to be sacrificed. You bring the best of your flock. Now that, of course, it lends itself, I think, to an understanding that you rightfully are cautioning against, Ted. But I also think the understanding was more so of a standard as opposed to kind of a demand, which is kind of how I think we understand and often read that. But I think it's also important to point out what's going on in Hebrew specifically is more so about wholeness and completeness than it is about an exactness, if you will, that we associate with the term perfection.
I'm waving the microphone around here. Anybody online that wants to speak up?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the physical imperfections being thought of as a result of some kind of sinning. And I think Jesus spoke out totally against that idea. He said, it rains on the just and the unjust alike. Mm-hmm. Whenever people were saying, you know, what sin has someone committed in order to make this bad thing happen to them? So I think he argued against that in a very strong way. I don't understand the connection really between the high priest and how... I don't think we're supposed to take that as what we expect Jesus to be as far as a physical perfection, because he broke that connection between sin and physical events. He said, there's not a connection here. So.
Yes.
And that was Bobby.
Thank you. Right. And I think that's part of what Hebrews is trying to emphasize in saying, right, that this priesthood is unlike any you've seen before, right? I mean, we see this throughout the Gospels. We see this in most every reference to Jesus is the emphasis is on how Jesus has totally changed our understanding of the world, right? We may think that we have to be perfect and holy, but no, we don't have to be. We don't have to be that because Jesus took on that burden, right? And so I think Hebrews is saying like, Jesus is like any other high priest that we have ever had before. And we won't need another priest because we have Jesus. So I think you're absolutely, absolutely right in kind of underscoring this distinction is, you know, while we're using this term, it was used to, I think, even in Hebrews, to try to help us to see that this is a new covenant over and over again, right? It says this is a new covenant. In fact, it says it's a better covenant. And so in order to explain that covenant, they're using the language of the previous covenant, right? And also the imagery, which we talked a little bit about last week, right? This imagery of the tabernacle, of priesthood, right? It lends itself to a very Jewish interpretation, rightfully so, of this, but making a distinction, using those images to make a distinction about who Jesus is and how Jesus is different from those who came before.
Jennifer, could I ask a question about that, please?
Sure.
I really like art. So when I look at those images and those pictures up there, I'm looking at what I think of as sort of a sweet Jesus, you know? And one of those was the image in the little Presbyterian church that I grew up with. So I've seen it since I was about five. But it never suggested to me that Jesus got mad in the temple, for example, and threw people out. And of course, there's the whole issue of how he really looks and does he really represent or did he represent the people where he was actually born, you know? But I'm curious about that whole piece of the image that has to do both with the physical, how it looks, but and trying to be representative, but at the same time, the image as we think of it, like you were describing it more in terms of how he behaved and what he did and said and so forth. It just seems to me that it's almost contradictory. I don't know. I wrestle with it, and I'm wondering if others do as well.
Or perhaps complementary in some ways, right? Because one of the titles, right, was Prince of Peace. Absolutely, right, that Jesus came to implement in many ways to show us a way, a different way, a peaceful way. But I appreciate the kind of, I too appreciate art, which is why I share these images with you. And in terms of historical reconstruction, it's kind of the second image in at the top is the most recent that I've come across, kind of attempt at a historical representation of Jesus. If we go to my next slide, I think it is where I kind of make the point is that we, at least through our expression through art, whether that's the images that you just saw or how we talk about or write about Jesus, we tend to make God into our own image, right? There was a Chinese Jesus and a Kenyan Jesus there on the slide in front of us. But what I think the text is trying to do, and perhaps even those images in some way, is to think about how we are being made into the image of God, right? And so that very beginning in describing Jesus as the very essence of God, right? An imprint of God is upon Jesus, right? I think is important for our understanding of our relationship of who we are. To God, right? That we too are an imprint, that we too contain the very essence of who God is, right? And how all of these new terms can help influence how we worship Jesus. And that is what a new covenant made possible, is that it changed the temple system, right? If you no longer need, well, there was no temple, right? If you no longer need the temple, you no longer needing to make sacrifices. And if that was your way of worshiping God, how now then do we worship God, right? Jesus gives us the possibility for thinking about what that looks like and what that means by the creation of, right? By living into what this writer at least calls this new covenant, this better covenant. And more importantly, over and over again, Jesus, I think, in this text is described as empathetic, literally as empathetic, as sympathetic, that we're given the reason why Jesus steps out of eternity into time, right? So that he may suffer so that we do not have to, right? So that we don't have to do that, right? And so recognizing that we are not alone becomes, I think, an important kind of theme of this text. In doing so, telling us why we are not alone, right? That Jesus has become all of these things to and for us. I don't need to be the last word, so I invite any kind of final thoughts, observations, continued conversation around these.
This is John Hayes.
Yes, John.
The way I see it is that all the images that we've been talking about are just images of a part of a greater whole that we can't really articulate. And that Jesus is not a body. He once was. He's not now. So he can't be. We can't describe how he looks. He's spirit. And in my own experience, I find Jesus is very close to me, almost like a brother, a big brother, you know, who is a son of God. But you know, in some ways, I'm in that same family. Sweet. And so. Is he a mediator? Yeah. Is he an advocate? Yeah. Is he a teacher? Yeah. He's everything. And there, you can make a list that could be as long as the world. And can, if you add them all together, they come up with a complex picture, which is love. So, you know, maybe that's a woke statement. And I enjoyed your discussion of that term woke very much.
Thank you.
Language is a problem.
It is.
We can't talk about God because God's inexpressible. And so anyhow, I've enjoyed this very much.
We are limited in some ways by language, right? Right. We don't always as saying this recently in conversation about the Pharisees, we don't always, it's a limitation. What is the other word that we can use in our, we don't have it sometimes. And so, so language can also be very limiting, but I do want to affirm both you, John, and whoever brought up Jesus as brother earlier. I have three sisters, two of whom are older, and understanding Jesus in this way is so helpful in that I think of how I relate to my sisters, right? And how, you know, I go to one for some particular kinds of advice and I'll go to another for a different kind of advice, right? So my oldest sister is much more of a mother figure in some ways for me. You know, I have a lot of life advice where my other sister, sometimes it's just more practical, like which shirt looks better or which shoes do you think go with this outfit? Or do you think this is a wise decision for me to travel here at this time, right? And that kind of intimacy in knowing, but also the complexity of that, right? Don't always get along, there's some conflict, but that intimacy and that complexity, I think is helpful for those of us who have siblings to think of Jesus in that regard. Another thing that might be helpful as I'm thinking through what these images do and help us in some ways is, I'm not a seamstress, I can't sew, but I do, but my mom did for a while when I was younger, and having a pattern, right, helps you to recreate something in a very exact way, right? And Jesus in some way gives us a pattern for us to recreate a life devoted to God. And so, you know, there are times when having that pattern, I think is helpful for us to return to especially given all the noise, if you will, in the world, both historically in the ancient world and in our world today.
This is Charlotte.
I wanted to ask a question about that comment. We made God in our own image instead of being made in the image of God. Mm-hmm. I'm really puzzling over that. It seems to me that that's, on one level, an easy way out. It doesn't challenge us if we have to try to identify with someone who's not like us. And of course, as a female, we're all, the female side of this issue is always dealing with a challenge in that regard, because Jesus is a male in a male image. But at the same time, and the flip side, it also makes it possible to identify. So it seems to me there's a real duality about making into one's own image. But I guess I think maybe the bottom line is it's much more of a challenge, and so we avoid it.
Yes, I appreciate that. I think you're right. I think you're right, period. A challenge that we have to live into. What does that mean? What does that mean? Yes.
I'll leave the last word to you.
I think I just want to set us up, if I can. Set us up for next week when we're going to be talking about some of the themes, which I think have come out so nicely today, and pick up on some of the threads from our earlier conversation around genealogy, to talk about in many ways how this book of Hebrews in and of itself provides for us, as does all of the Bible in many ways, a way for us to grow into this image that we're kind of talking about. And so one of the important messages I think here is to imitate Jesus. And how do we do that, right? And how do we do that? And that is the question that I'm hoping that we will be talking about next week, as we're talking about rest. If there's a reason to come back, I hope that's one, right? It's like, this is one of the texts that is talking about rest, R-E-S-T. You need to rest. And what does that mean? It's also talking about faithfulness. It's also talking about hospitality and community. And these are all things, right? All things that I think are important for us to think about and to consider as we are trying every day. To be more and more, right? That's what being a Christian is, right? To be more and more like Christ. So look forward to continuing the conversation next week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.